Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, and today on heritageradionetwork.org, we have a very special guest who actually has come a very long way to be on the, well, I don't think he came to be on the show, he actually came for Le Fooding that's going to take place in New York this weekend, but a very unique chef. Daniel Rose is an American from Chicago who went to Paris, went to France, and has probably a dream restaurant that a lot of American chefs dream about. He's got a small, incredibly successful restaurant in Paris, France. Welcome, Daniel, and the question of the moment is, how did you do it? But first, I think that we're going to have a little bit of time to get there. So welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
How do you like New York?
I love New York City.
Really?
I don't get to come here very often, but it's such a difference from Paris. I mean, a lot of things are different, but the rhythm is much... it's actually quite frightening, because Paris shuts down at about 9:30 at night and wakes up again at about 9:30. So there's 12 hours of silence, but here there's it doesn't seem to stop.
No, it's the city that never sleeps,
yeah.
Right?
And that's, yeah. And it really is quite overwhelming. And there's always interesting people doing interesting things. There's music, there's theater, there's... But I don't have a very good perspective, because when everyone says it's a dream to live in Paris, and I dream of living in New York City.
Do you?
Sure, yeah.
Oh.
But it always looks like that, I mean, from far away.
That's right. Well, so how many years have you lived in Paris, or in France? Right?
I have been living in... I arrived in Paris in August of 1998, so it's 14 years and 22 days and 16 hours.
Okay, all right. I like precision there. So let's... Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Chicago, outside of Chicago, the northern suburbs, in a suburb called Wilmette. Which lots of people know because it's a very famous high school. Went to the same high school as Charlie Trotter, apparently.
People, you know Charlie?
I don't know him, no. But
he's a great guy.
We've never met.
Oh.
I grew up in a very pretty, quiet, family-oriented...
How was the food in the house?
Great. My mother is an excellent cook, although she's, I think, as soon as all the kids... left, she decided that she would go out to restaurants more than she would cook. But the best restaurant in Chicago is at my mother's house. It's maybe the hardest reservation to get.
What kind of food does she cook?
I think there was a period where she was making a different meal every night for, you know, every night except a few holidays.
Did you cook with her?
I don't think, not actively, but it definitely wore off. I also have a memory of a Chinese nanny named Jia Ling that used to make me these crazy Chinese omelets every time my mother would make something I didn't want to eat.
Tell me about the omelet.
It was a few eggs beaten with I think there must have been sugar and salt and probably some sauce in it. Yeah, soy sauce or something. And it was kind of greasy and fried. It was very delicious, and it was very thin. So it wasn't like a French omelet. It wasn't really an omelet. It was sort of like a kind of thin egg crepe.
Yeah, a lot more oil in the pan.
Totally, it was delicious. Got a little crunchy.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
So when did you get? When you went to school, what were you dreaming of being? Did you always have a dream to be a chef?
No, I went to school to study philosophy and history of mathematics first. And then I think I cooked a little on the side. I remember cooking for a girlfriend once, and I went to the market and I bought tomatoes and onions. And I had never actually done anything before, and a piece of salmon or something. And I mixed it all together, and I remember watching my mom add like a little vinegar and a little sugar and all this. And apparently I had made something that resembled ketchup by the time I was done. But there was a desire to cook, but I had no desire.
Aspiration.
I thought,
were you studying philosophy and mathematics? That's kind of scary.
First I was in St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Oh my God, that one where you studied the classics?
Yeah, so
oh,
I studied
is that cool?
Ancient Greek, and yeah, it was very cool. So cool, in fact, that after 2 years of isolation in the desert of Santa Fe, I decided I needed to move far away. So I moved to Paris.
Oh, so anyway, tell me a little more about St. John's and for people who don't know it and how different it is as a college.
So I think I went there because there were no grades, and that was the most attractive part to me. I mean, I was, 18, and I just was looking for the easiest way to get through school, or so I thought. But it turned out that it wasn't easy. And essentially, everybody studies the same thing at the same time. And so the freshmen all enter school, and everybody reads the first chapter of the Iliad, and then starts...
In Greek?
In Greek, in English, and then during the day, you'd study enough Greek to start doing translations. And then I remember very well, I think one of the most memorable moments, maybe in my entire life, even including all of the cooking things, was a 7-foot-tall German woman who was teaching mathematics, Euclidean geometry, and the first day of class there was a big blackboard. Her name was Nancy Buchenauer. She was very tall and quite eccentric, and she took a line of chalk and drew it across the board, and she said, "Now what is this?" And there was a bunch of like 8 very nervous 18-year-old kids who thought they knew a lot staring at this line across the chalkboard, and everyone was, "What is this?" And she says, "This is a piece of a line that's the size of the universe." And I think at that point I was like, "I like this place." I didn't know why. I didn't know why, but I was moved by that moment. And so there were lots of interesting, really, what it is, while you're studying Euclidean geometry and reading the Iliad and translating the Bible, for example, from Greek to English, it really isn't so much about the substance of what you're doing, but the process. So you're really gaining lots of tools for learning. And this is probably the most... I mean, if people say, what's the reason you became a cook? It really was because of that, because cooking is a way of continuing that learning process all the time. And so it never, people say that a lot, but it's provided a gateway into all sorts of different things, whether it's, for me, it was France, cooking in general. In the same way that I went back and studied ancient Greek, which everyone had studied for a very long time already, I study the Fines Herbes. So instead of going into nuclear science, I was looking at old ideas about how the universe was put together, and instead of taking new chemicals and mixing something new, I'm looking at, parsley, tarragon, chervil. It's in some ways those classic things are still uncharted territory. And so I really see a very deep link between the studying at St. John's, the process of learning, and my career, my life in some ways.
So when did the food bulb go off?
So I was always very hungry, I think.
desert.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was always interested in eating. But that was part of our family life, and this was, you go on vacation, you go somewhere where there's something that's good to eat as well. You go to Mexico or you go somewhere else. It was always very important. I think I remember trying to make an apple pie when I was at St. John's College. I think for the same girlfriend, actually. And I made the dough. I followed the recipe, and it was quite thick. Mm. And of course, I didn't pre-bake it because I hadn't thought of that. Mm. I didn't read carefully enough the instructions because I was too excited to do it. Mm. So I made the dough and I stuck it in the tart shell, and I put the raw apples on top. And of course, I made a big mess. Big gooey thing that wasn't particularly delicious. And it didn't smell anything like what I thought it was going to smell like. And I don't even think we ate it. In fact, I think I was so ashamed of it, I put it right in the trash.
Is this with the salmon and the vegetables?
So the apple pie happened at St. John's, and then in the middle of St. John's, I transferred to Paris because I thought that I wanted to, that it was interesting to have this insulated learning experience, but that I needed to be complemented by going out in the world. I had never stepped foot in France. I had never.
What appealed about France?
I honestly thought that, I mean, I was 19, so put this in some perspective. But I honestly thought that all of the girls in France wore only suspenders. I think that I had this, I was really.
Suspenders?
Yeah. I really thought that. I had seen a movie once when I was a kid that.
Were they wearing anything other than the suspenders?
No, I think in the movie they were wearing suspenders and they were speaking French, and I thought, that looks like a place I'd like to go. You know, there's a place in France where the naked ladies dance and there's a hole in the wall.
Yeah, I think it's called the Crazy Horse, actually.
I've never been there, actually. So it was really about mythology of France. So it was, what did I know about France? It was the Eiffel Tower and pretty girls, and I thought they all rode around on bicycles with baguettes. I mean,
That's what you get for studying the classics, quite frankly. You don't know what the moderns are really doing.
I really didn't. I never made it to the French curriculums because I was too busy studying Greek. But I really just, it was really just a sort of, it was a, you know, we fantasize about what cooking is like in Lyon, for example.
Exactly.
About the mythology of cooking in Lyon. It's the same thing. I mean, I just sort of went. And what happened was it turned out that what I really found was something that was obviously much more, there was much more substance than just a bunch of pretty girls, and it turns out there's lots of pretty girls in France too. But
so you transferred to the American University?
I transferred to the American University of Paris.
And what was that like after St. John's?
It was wonderful because it was the opposite of this insular, very, very. I mean, basically, when you. Every time you ask a question at St. John's College, you're asking a question that is so big that you are never going to get an answer. And so it can be very, when you're 19...
Like the line.
Like think about the line the size of the universe across the chalkboard. I mean, you could spend 100 years thinking about that in all sorts of different ways, which is tremendously exciting, but at the same time, it's a little bit daunting. So I think I needed some sort of real curriculum where it was like, this is art history, and this is the Louvre, and this is what happened, you know, and the Louvre was built by François I, and this, and then it was added on. So I moved from something that was sort of, I mean, it's like anything you learn. You have to begin with, I think I jumped right into the big questions, but because I didn't know anything about the details, it was hard to form any real... to have any real direction. So it's like cooking, you know, people say, I want to be a chef, but they don't know about how to hold a knife or something like that. And
what was the culture of France compared to America? We're all getting to get know you a little better, and it's obvious that you're an intellectual and have a lot of brain power. And France is known or prides itself on its intellectual, you know, coteries and people talking. So did you find a huge cultural shift coming from the Midwest, Mexico, going to a very intellectual college, and then going to Paris? What kind of seismic cultural schism was there between the States and France?
I think my first 2 years in Paris were at the American University of Paris, so I wasn't quite in France yet. It was a kind of an airlock. But I was with lots of people from around the world. So I was in school with people from Iran, from Lebanon, from Libya, from Egypt, from Australia, from Colombia. So it was quite an awakening to the way in which, I mean, you can drive 22 hours in the United States and still not get to the end. In Europe, you drive 22 hours and you've gone through three countries and maybe more and 6 different languages. Mm. So I think it was a real, there was a real emphasis on education that was, like here where we were geared to, we were engineered to go to college and stuff, but we weren't really engineered to be educated in a way. It's just, I don't know if that makes any sense, but and it's
a
subtle difference.
I think we look at college as the prelude to getting a job.
Yes.
And there's something about European universities that you're going there to be educated.
Yeah. This is also part of a long process that's something that, I mean, the French are known for that, and the Americans adopted it in some way. The American democracy works because we pride ourselves on being able to create liberally educated young people who can make decisions about...
And lots of them. It's not an elitist pursuit.
But it's been sort of... It's been morphed into a very career-oriented... Mm. College is a date. Yeah. Yeah, it's a vehicle for getting a job, for making sure your life is, you know, full of the things you want it to be full of.
So now you're at the university, and you were there. Did you finish your degree?
I did. It took me a little longer than I had thought. I sort of dropped out after the first year. I tried to join the French Foreign Legion.
Did you really?
Yes.
What was that like?
It lasted about an hour.
Why?
Because I think they realized quickly that I was not a good candidate for being in the military, and certainly not in the French Foreign Legion, which was, at the time, this was 1998, so it was full of... Essentially, I was in a room with a bunch of ex-Serb mercenaries who had just spent a lot of years killing lots of people, and I think that they thought they were probably better candidates than this kid who was...
Is there an office in Paris where you
it's
go?
It's just outside of Paris. It's at Fort Nogent, and you can take the train there. I showed up in my Birkenstocks and with my big smile and was like...
Without the girlfriend.
I went actually with a Colombian friend of mine who to this day, who he was kind of egging me on. He's like, you go. It was really very silly.
What was appealing about the French Foreign Legion? Because it is, you know, cutthroat killers.
It is cutthroat killers, but I think that there's a...
Are you a cutthroat killer?
No, I don't.
You're glad to
well,
hear it.
Yeah,
with the animals, I guess. You know?
And even then, maybe less. But no, I think there was this desire for a total immersion into something with a real, concrete discipline. Kind of an, I mean, this notion of loyalty, this abstraction from this sort of adopted patriotism. I mean, the force of the French Foreign Legion may or may not be how well they fight, but it really is about how they've just decided that this is what their allegiance is. Mm. And it's very powerful, I think. I mean, we have opportunities to make... How many times in your life are you in a position to make a decision about that's as strong as something like that, as deciding I'm going to be a soldier. This is.
Well, you could have joined the American Army. And
I thought about that too. I thought about that too. I think that I was looking for some kind of decision, some kind of creating some kind of moment like that in life that was very decisive. Mm. And I don't. I mean, it was a bit of mythology too. I thought, the French Foreign Legion. I'm going to go out to the desert and roast lambs over the fire. And I guess I was still dreaming about food. Actually.
So they rejected you.
They rejected me very quickly, like within an hour.
Oh, but that's really important to put on your resume. I mean, not many people have been rejected by the French Foreign Legion.
I think it's easy to be rejected by the French Foreign
Legion. It's easy, but not many people go for it.
Nobody went for it. Yeah. And I went back to school, and then I eventually graduated, and I thought, what am I going to do now? And I was interested in... I had spent 2 years in Paris, and I hadn't been a very good student of French, and I thought, I've been in Paris for 2 years and I don't speak French, and if I'm interested in making these decisions that are sort of intense, then there's no way that I can go back to the States and be like, I lived in France for 2 years but not have any real roots. Mm. Not have learned the language, not have understood the culture. Mm. And it turns out that it's going to take 30 years before I really start to understand some of these things, so that's why I'm still there. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, what's the best way to learn more about France? Well, it's one, to get out of Paris, and then to do something that is essentially French, which is to learn about restaurants. Mm. This is, I mean, there is something that all the restaurants in New York City today function more or less. Even the Chinese restaurants are essentially French restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
The technique is different, of course, but they're
the way they're constructed,
the way the customer interacts with them is very French. It was born during the Revolution. There's a lot of interesting social aspects to it. And so I wanted to learn about France. In order to learn about France globally, I needed to learn about something very specific, and so it was restaurants.
And so how did you do that?
So I went to Lyon, because somebody told me that Paul Bocuse was the pope of French cooking, and I believed them. And I went to Lyon and enrolled in the Institut Bocuse.
And how was that?
That was excellent. It was a real awakening, because I think that I was a very eager student, and I already had a degree in, you know, too many years of college. So I was at once the ideal candidate to learn French cooking, because I had all these tools about how to learn. But at the same time, I wasn't the best candidate for the school, because I was a little too... I couldn't sit still, really. And I went...
Were you demanding of your teachers?
I was demanding of my teachers. I think I was probably slightly provocative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had to wear uniforms and stuff like this. And even though I had this desire to... I think I couldn't fathom wearing a cooking school uniform when a year before I had been considering wearing a uniform for the French Foreign Legion.
But no, you're in cooking school, and it's a chef's uniform.
It's a chef's uniform, but outside of the school, we had to wear these polyester suits with a red tie. And
no.
Yeah, absolutely. I still have it, actually. I don't think it fits. But yeah, we had to wear and there was things about how, you know, your haircut had to be a certain way, and that wasn't really that big of a deal. But I think the first day of school, I went to the directrice and I said, you know, here I am. You know, school is from 9 in the morning until 6 at night. And so from 7:30 until 1 in the morning, I intend to go work in a restaurant. And even if it's in doing the dishes. And she says, oh, no, 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 no. We don't do that here. And I thought, that's the strangest thing in the world. If we had been in New York City and some eager young student came to you and said, I really want to get in, and I don't care if I'm, you know, peeling, you know, artichokes with a toothpick or whatever.
Most of our students at ICC do that.
Yeah, and so. there was a bit of, I thought, this is strange. Mm. I mean, here you have all this energy from all these students that are really eager to learn stuff, and there were some obstacles in the way of doing it. But it was a really wonderful place, and we had Mets Ouvriers de France as it was my first introduction to the Mets Ouvriers de France, which was...
Well, we're going to get into that. Now we're going to take a little break,
okay.
And we're going to come right back, and we're going to get into how your cooking career started. So, hold on.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, 5 generations, 145 years. Full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Well, hello. You're listening to Chef's Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today, my chef is Chef Daniel Rose of Spring Restaurant in Paris, a young American chef who has found his way to Paris and has taken them by storm. We're right in the middle of his story, and you were just telling us about being at the Institut Paul Bocuse in Lyon and studying. And so when you graduated from there, you were there for a year or two?
I didn't graduate. I spent a year there, and then I went on my first internship, like you do between school years.
Right.
And it was 2001, and so just at the during the break, September 11th happened, and I decided that instead of going back to school, I would just stay. I asked the chef that I was working with, who was a maître de France in Brittany, who I had a very privileged relationship with, and it was a really excellent place. And he basically had proposed to me to stay on instead of going back to
school. Explain to people what a maître de France is.
A maître de France is somebody that's awarded a sort of like an honorary degree from the French government that is a recognition of your level of the quality of your work. And it's a competition. And so there could be, at any one time, it's not whoever wins the competition, it's whoever meets the qualifications of being a maître de France. And it can be in anything. It can be in cooking, it can be in chair making, it can be in basket weaving, it can be in boat building, chocolate making, pastry. It covers a lot of different things. In knitting, I think there's even a knitting maître de France.
Really?
And the idea is that they really take into account a lot of different criteria. So it's once your technical skills, but it's also your ability to teach others. It's really the. Well, I've met a lot of 3-star Michelin chefs, for example, who are very good at what they do. There's nothing that, except for their own ambition, and even outside of the quality of the restaurant, they're linked by their ambition. The maître de France is linked really by, and those that qualify are really linked by a very something quite different, which is really simply the quality of their work. Some of them have restaurants that I found not particularly good, but they themselves have this award, and they are just,
it's the most prestigious, I think.
For me, it's the most prestigious, yeah.
Both André Soltner, which are, you know, everyone in the United States knows of, the legendary Lutèce, and Jacques Torres is actually the youngest pastry chef to win it at the time. So we have a few that are living here in the States.
And they really are. I mean, I'm just in awe, you know, I mean,
of
the quality of their work. And so the opportunity for me to work alongside one who said, it was a small restaurant in Brittany, and there were 24 seats, and he made a unique menu every night. And he would come in with a case of artichokes and say, okay, you don't know anything about artichokes, so here you go. And then the next day he'd say, you've never seen this kind of crustacean before, so here you go. And so he was really
And he was
actively,
your personal tutor.
He was my personal tutor. And he taught me things that today I find myself telling interns in my own restaurant and pinching myself going, like, this is unbelievable. This doesn't make any sense. Everything I learn, and I'm not talking about recipes, because recipes can be learned many different ways, but about the quality of work, about the relationship with the customer, about your own. He told me that someday, at 5 in the morning, after maybe a kind of a drunken romp around this small town together, there's nothing to do. He, over a baguette that came out of the boulangerie oven from his buddy who owned the boulangerie next door, with this beautiful butter from Brittany on this hot baguette, he said two things. He said, if I could, I would serve my customers bread and butter, because this is the most delicious thing I've ever eaten. And just after that, he said, someday you will find yourself alone. Your wife will leave you. You will be all alone. And you'll be left with nothing but your own métier.
Meaning your own craft.
Yeah. And he was right on both those counts, turned out.
Oh, my.
But, and so from that, yeah, I mean, it was like, I was like, and then, of course, I learned this great recipe for crème citron and a great recipe for almond puree and a kind of a vision about cooking that really was open enough so that it was so wide open, in fact, that it created, and this is 10 or 12 years later, enough material for a lifetime's worth of work. And that is pretty...
How long did you stay with him? No, chefs do that in France.
He was promoting me.
Yeah, yeah. And where did you go?
I ended up going to the south of France, near Avignon, to one of his buddies who had a very different restaurant, a 1 Michelin star restaurant, that was very busy in the summer and less busy in the winter. And of course, we were very far from Brittany because we were, you know, in Brittany it was all about the ocean and kind of rustic Celtic culture. And then, of course, in outside of Avignon, it was all about olives and strong and Syrah and lambs and different, you know, the style had changed. Mm. And also the type of business that this other chef was.
Did you miss the first chef? Or were you excited by this new landscape?
I was excited by the new landscape, and I never was really very far away from him because he had given me all the stuff that I could take with me. Mm. So I never felt like I never missed it because he had opened up the world in some way to me.
So how long did it take for you to get to the point where you felt you could open your own place?
Well, I think lots of young cooks, you're never really ready to open your own place. The only thing that makes you ready for it is when you decide to do it. You know, there are lots of, when are you ready? Today, kids come to me and they say, I want to open my own restaurant. And I think, damn, if I was in your position, I would still be a stagiaire. I want to go work for Daniel Hum at 11 Madison. I think I could spend a year there and learn all sorts of stuff. I want to go see what Alfred Portal does in somewhere else, and I want to go work for Joël Robuchon. It's, you know, there's just a point at which you decide that you're going to open a restaurant. I think I thought that I was quite ready for it early. I also knew when I decided that I was going to open a restaurant. I was working at the Hotel Maurice.
Who's the chef there? Yannick
Aleno.
Yeah.
So I had just come back to France from a year in Guatemala.
How did you get to Guatemala?
So I worked in Avignon, and all this time I had no working papers. So I have a first world problem, which at this point was that I had no working papers. Big deal. I obviously wasn't suffering, and yes, you can apply the word clandestine to my experience, but this is not. This is not that interesting. But I just, they just, you know, would pay me in cash, and I couldn't really have any responsibilities. So I thought, I'm going to go back to, it was 2003. I'm going to go back to the United States and see if I can work in a restaurant. And I came to, I went to Chicago, and I spent a day at True and a day at, maybe 2 days at North Pond. And I saw lots of neat things, and I thought, oh, this is great. But I realized that what I liked about cooking wasn't the cooking; it was all the other things that I was learning, and I felt like by entering in there that those experiences, at least on a superficial level, weren't as enriching. So I answered an ad in the newspaper for this hotel in Guatemala that was a very chic little place. People used to fly in from Guatemala City by helicopter, and it was in some ways more French than France. They really were picking asparagus in the morning, and the strawberries were very local, and they had all these beautiful little flowers and very exotic fruits and stuff, and it was quite a privileged environment. I was the chef. And it was great. It was really wonderful. I had a kitchen full of, well, the guy who was my sous chef was about 45 years old, and he one day showed me a picture of his family, and he gave me the picture, and there were 7 kids in it. And then he told me that actually there are so many children, he has so many children, that he needed to take 2 pictures. And he showed me another picture with another 7 children. The guy had 14 children. We spoke a little bit of Spanish. We spoke a little bit of Quiche. And I learned to communicate. I think in the beginning it was a rather intense relationship we all had. But in the end, we really understood each other. And what we understood all together was, in the end, instead of saying, do it like this and do it like that, it was, I would show them one way and then show them another way, and then they would say, ah, that one's prettier than this one. And then they would make the prettier one. It was incredibly exciting. But
how long were you there?
A year.
Okay. And so, yeah. Wait, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, I hope you're going you got to Paris. Yeah. We'll get into spring. Mm. Okay. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my chef
is Daniel Rose, who the owner and executive chef of Spring in Paris, one of the most feted and probably one of the hardest restaurants to get into in Paris. And we've just kind of tiptoed through his interesting life, and I guess we're getting close to your return to Paris and opening your restaurant there. How did that happen? How did Spring come about?
So I moved back from Guatemala to Paris. I got married. So finally I had working papers.
Not to the girlfriend you were making the bed.
No. She made a good move and ducked out a long time before that. She was, yeah. I married a French woman that I was in love with, and I started working at the Hotel Maurice because he knew the chef that I worked for in Avignon, and I was in September or late August of 2004. They were working very hard to get, either they had just gotten it or they were working very hard to get the third Michelin star. It was an interesting environment, and it was pretty crazy. But I learned a lot, and then after about 3 months of that, I thought, I think it's time for me to... I didn't see myself starting out as a demi-chef de partie and then becoming a chef de partie and then becoming a sous chef in this environment. I thought that I needed to do my own thing. So I quit my job at the Hotel Maurice. I'm sure they didn't miss me. In fact, the chef, we had a very poignant moment. I remember where the chef apologized to me, because he knew that the difficulty in trying to get a third Michelin star meant that he couldn't have a relationship with his cooks that he really wanted. It was a very poignant moment and very brief, but it was like, I'm going to get 3 Michelin stars and there's no room to, and I need guys that already know how to do this very well, there's no room to educate others, at least at this point. Now I think it's quite different. But so I left, and I thought, okay, now I'm going to open a restaurant. But I really didn't have that much experience. And so I started thinking about what kind of restaurant I could open. How could I get the best quality for the customer? You know, how could I make something that would be good? And I realized that would have to be very, very small. And so I started looking around for places. And it turned out that there was a lot of things I needed to learn. So in between time, I started selling books for a German editor in Paris because of my art history background. And it gave me enough time to... Cooking and trying to open a restaurant are trying to invent a restaurant, at least in your own mind, takes a lot of energy. So I needed free time in order to do that. So getting a regular job was the best way to do that. And I don't remember, it was about 9 months or so. It seemed like a long time at the time, but now it doesn't even appear on the radar. And I found this teeny tiny little place in the ninth that was 26 square meters. That was a restaurant called Le Coup de Fouet. The whip of the whisk, and it was owned by this guy that was half American and half French, and it was like, I walked in and it was so small that I thought, I can do something in here, this is it, and I did 3 months of renovation on 26 square meters. I gutted the place. I installed an open kitchen.
Personally, working on it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't do all the stuff that requires actual skill, but mm-hmm. I was there all the time. And we took off the front of the facade and put up these glass doors. And that was the first restaurant Spring. And on the 13th of October, I had this business plan, which was if at least 8 people come to the restaurant a day, I could survive.
Wow.
And the first day I opened the door and 2 people came. I didn't invite anyone or anything. And then they said, oh... can our friends come on Friday? And they made reservations for their friend on Friday. And then for 2 days, there was no one in the restaurant. And then on Friday, there were 4. And then the next week, there was 8. And then there was 12. And then there was 16. The restaurant was full. And I couldn't turn tables because I was the only person cooking and doing the dishes and writing out the notes for everyone after. And, you know, I was basically a one-man show. And then...
You don't mean washing the dishes.
I mean washing the dishes. There was nobody else working in the restaurant except for me. It was... And I was making a new menu in the morning.
Who was serving the plate?
I was. It was the place was no bigger than the room we're sitting in. It was very teeny tiny.
Wow.
And on the 2nd of November, Emmanuel Rubin from the Figaro apparently had been there a week before, and he wrote this article, which today was probably the most poignant thing that was ever said, the most important thing that was ever said about this restaurant. And he wasn't talking about the food, but he said, this restaurant is, you know, I like it and it's tasty and stuff, but this restaurant isn't a restaurant that resembles life. And I thought, that's pretty heavy duty. And now that I look back, I see that the attraction to the restaurant wasn't necessarily the food, although we weren't making anything that was bad. I'd love to make that. I'd like to give somebody else that responsibility, but I was all by myself. And it was a restaurant that reaffirmed life in some way. It was an act.
What did he mean by that, and what do you take from that?
Meaning that what you want when you go to a restaurant. Well, this was 2006. There was a bistronomy movement that was beginning. There was Yves Camdebord at the Régalade. But there really wasn't this move. Like, we had the same suppliers as the Hotel Maurice. I served the same pigeon that I learned to make at the Hotel Maurice. In a completely different environment. And the menu was like 36 euros or something. And I would go in the morning and go shopping and put it all on my scooter and then come back and I had no idea what
so
I was doing.
It was like giving a dinner party every night.
It's like giving a dinner party, yeah. And just like people at a dinner party, I really hoped that people wouldn't stay for coffee because I was so exhausted at the end of the day and I had to think about what I was going to make the next day. And for me, it was
and
a real...
And you made money at this restaurant?
I have no idea. I haven't stopped to count, but...
well, you know, it evicted you from your apartment.
Well,
so you
so this restaurant was... The rent was 600 euros a month. I invested 140,000 euros into it. I sold it for 80,000, which sounds like a loss, except that through another maneuver, I leveraged the success and the clientele that I had at this old restaurant to put it into the new restaurant Spring. So if you want to... So while I'm describing this process of not counting the money, I was well aware that I was, that on paper at least, I was creating... It
value.
Was a really a very successful business proposition. Mm-hmm. But it's a bit like a lemonade stand. I mean, if you buy 50 euros worth of lemons and sell 150, this is a very successful business. It's just not enough volume to actually be of any.
So the first restaurant was named Spring?
The first restaurant was named Spring.
How'd you come up with the name?
I had another name for a restaurant that I don't want to say because it was really kind of dumb. And then there was this moment where I was trying to think of a name that didn't, that had many different possibilities. And so I thought, there was the same reason why I called it Spring was the same reason why Emmanuel Rubin said that it was a restaurant that resembled life, because it was about, it wasn't about restauranting, it was about sort of doing something and saying, you know, here we are. And there
so was
this,
a wellspring as opposed to the season.
It was something of the season. I mean, I've never met anyone in the world that on the around, you know, late March after the winter walks outside and takes a whiff of the air and the ground thawing. I mean, here in New York, it's like that as well, like it was in Chicago, and says, "Oh, can I can swear on this?
Yeah.
Oh shit, the spring is coming." Nobody has ever said that.
They do say it about winter.
They do say it about winter. And then there was this idea of spring water, a kind of a very clean source and the beginning of something. And then there was this kind of, some guy brought me a card the other day. He actually makes springs in a factory outside of Chicago. There was this kind of, I was this bouncy kid that didn't really, a spring is all potential energy, right?
Mm.
It's something that gets squished and then it's uncontrollable. It gets squished and then it bounces in any direction that it and that's exactly what I had no vision about what was going to happen.
It's
I just
needed infinite line coil.
So it was something like that, yeah. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I just went and did it. And then that led to a second restaurant, Spring, where we are now, which is a much different thing. There's 20 people working there. We have a huge... The wine cellar we have is as big as the first Spring restaurant. There's, I think, 20 people working and 14 different nationalities working there.
What gives you the most joy today in that restaurant?
Gives me the most joy today is watching other people take the same pleasure that I got when I did my work before. So watching people, essentially what I did was just say, okay, I can't do this all by myself, and now you do it. And this is the reason why I do it, is because by nature, this is what gives me pleasure. And so, here you go. And when I see somebody else, you know, we have lots of, a restaurant is really a series of tools to make people have a nice time. And whether it's food or service or wine, there's many different opportunities to make people, to connect with people in some way, and to have people say, wow, this is, I feel special, or I, or this is something that, this is the only place in the world where I should be right now. Mm. Now, that doesn't happen with everyone. Some people walk in and go, this is boring, or, you know, but that's well eclipsed by even the one or two people a week or a month that say, this is really, there's something going on here, and it inspires me, or, I mean, what is an excellent restaurant? The excellent, do you remember the meal you had when you proposed to somebody for marriage? No. You remember feeling like you were in love. That's all. We don't remember the food. We remember a lot of other different things. So I think my greatest pleasure today is watching all these other people who've said, oh, I want to do like Danny Rose does. And it's not exactly about how I cook, although it might be sometimes. But it's about how all those little details put together can be very satisfying to people. And it's not just about having dinner. So
unfortunately, we're kind of winding down because I'd like to open another frontiers about food, actually. We haven't talked about food.
I'm hungry.
But I hope when I come to Paris, I can interview you again and we can have part two to this. How did the other French chefs view you, especially when Figaro's, you know, jumping up and down?
So in 2008, there was an article in the Figaro, which was, this was now 2 years later, that listed the most difficult reservations to get in Paris. And so it started with the Pré Catelan, and then Le Table Joël Robuchon, 1 month for reservations, and then it went through Pascal Barbeau at L'Astrance and Pierre Gagnère, and then at the top of the list was Spring Restaurant. And I thought, now it had nothing to do with the quality of the food we were making. It did mark a moment in Parisian food, not history, because that's too heavy duty, but a moment that was saying, you know,
what? In Parisian restaurant history, absolutely.
Maybe. But it was a really, I was giggling the whole day. I thought, this is incredible. And even though I was in the same list with all of these other chefs, today we are more well known in New York City than we are in Paris. So I still have chefs. I put out an ad for cooks in the 3-star Michelin world because, of course, I want their experience and their talent and their capacity for work, who have never heard of Spring Restaurant because we are completely off the map, which is good and bad. But we're really very isolated in our.
So if you go to eat at L'Astrance or Pierre Gagnère, does the chef treat you like a chef, like they would a buddy French chef, or do they think you're l'Américain?
I don't think they have any notion of
who you are.
Who I am. I don't think they know anything about
je ne peux pas le croire. I can't.
I really don't. I really. I mean, I. Yeah, I really don't. I think Pierre Gagnère has heard about. By the way, I'm a big fan, Pierre. In fact, but I think it's a different. I think they see us as part of this world of, you know, buzz and little substance, and you know, it's a funny. You know, they're running real big businesses, and this is where like little. We're not really. We don't really exist yet. In some way. But that's also part of Paris.
Okay, can I suggest something? I'd love to do part two with you. And next time I'm in Paris, there's a couple of things. I'd love to get together with you and Pierre Gagnère and have him on the show. And we'll talk. What's his perception of you? What's your perception of him? And then I'd like to come into the restaurant and maybe talk to some of your French patrons and say, what is it about this food? And can you tell he's not... Well, I don't know what else, but maybe is he an American chef to you or a French chef? And then we're going to actually talk about your food, which we didn't get to today. So is that a deal?
That's great.
Okay, all right.
Better start cooking now.
Okay, well, thank you, Daniel, so much. Welcome to New York. Come back often.
Thank you.
And I hope we can cook together sometime. And I want to thank everybody out in Chef Story World there. This has been an exciting day interviewing Daniel. I want to do a shout out to my producers, Jack Inslee and Robin Cohen and Heidi Tickle and Joe Sevier. So this is Chef Story signing off. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.